Whenever you're ready. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll be reporting on the recommendations in the council folder from last month's Science and Statistical Committee meeting. We had three major items dealing with three different plans. In the SCOLLOP plan, we dealt with socioeconomic impact analysis and the methods for doing so. We have two memos in your package. One are recommendations to the council. The other is more technical feedback to the SCOLLOP plan development team. The second major item was Monkfish, Amendment 5, methods for determining acceptable biological catch. And you have a memo in the folder on recommendations to the council. The third major item was habitat, phase two, methods for evaluating effect of fishing on habitat. And you have two memos in your folder, one with recommendations to the council, one with technical feedback to the habitat plan development team. Okay, go for it.
The memo was passed. The memos were passed out this morning, document number 8. So they were put at your place sometime before you all came in for the meeting, if you're shuffling for them.
I'll give people a moment to find those again. There's one package, and it has five separate memos on these three items. All right, our agenda for March 17th, 18th meeting was to deal with these three items as well as some other business the SSC had. We had 11 members in attendance, so we continue to have strong participation. And with your approval, we also invited a temporary member, Dr. Robert Whitlock from University of Connecticut, who's a benthic ecologist, to help with the habitat review. Also looking forward a little bit on what our next meeting will cover. Monkfish, herring, and groundfish, and looking forward to the summer and a workshop that we'll be convening on ecosystem-based fishery management. And then through the Wednesday and Thursday agenda, dealt with scallop, monkfish, and habitat. So I'll go over these individually, starting out with scallops. You may remember that this was an unfinished task from our February meeting in which the council asked us to recommend on socioeconomic methods focused on the issue to address excess capacity and in so doing evaluate different options for stacking and leasing. There were many technical issues that we gave back to the PDT with respect to their cost-benefit analysis, but our recommendations are more focused on the stacking and leasing issue. Just in a general sense, we realized that the SSC is primarily focused on providing recommendations on acceptable biological catch, and that pertains to National Standard 1. But National Standard 8 is no less important, and so we do need to consider fishing communities and considering economic and social data in our impact analyses. With respect to stacking and leasing, it seems like one of the most controversial issues is fishing power adjustments. And this table is provided in the PDT's document, and it is essentially a coefficient in which vessels that buy or lease days from another vessel with different fishing power will have adjustment to those days. And I'll just walk you through this table. We have different categories here ranked by tonnage, gross registered tons. So if a vessel that's in the 150-ton range buys from a vessel in the 50-ton range, the coefficient would be 0.81. So for every 100 days that they lease, they would only get 81. Or for every 10 days that they lease, they would get 8. So there would be an adjustment for the fishing power of different vessels by size. As you can see, if a vessel buys up, then it gets a coefficient of 1. So it gets a straight use of the days at sea from the larger vessel. If a vessel buys from a smaller vessel, it would get a coefficient of less than one. These coefficients were derived from recent catch unit effort data. And as such, the SSC warns that they are conditional on the suite of regulations in which they were collected. Particularly, trip limits, crew size limits tend to equalize the fishing power of vessels. And if the council were considering relaxing those constraints, then these coefficients would be underestimated. Under crew size limits and trip limits, the larger vessel fishes more equally to the small vessel, and if those are relaxed, the larger vessel would have a much greater fishing power than the smallest vessel. So again, if regulations are proposed to be changed, then these coefficients should be re-estimated, but also consider that once a permit is bought for stacking, that's a permanent transfer. There's another adjustment that's proposed by the plan development team, and that is for increased returns, and that allows for the increased efficiency of a single vessel getting allocated more days at sea. However, the SSC feels that this is an unfinished analysis, that as a fishing vessel approaches full-time fishing, there's actually diminishing returns for increased days at sea allocations, and so we're asking for further analysis of the basis of this increased returns adjustment. Moving on to the last aspect of the socioeconomic impact methods, the plan development team provide a scoping document on what could be included in social impacts, and we were lucky to have several socioeconomic scientists on the SSC to provide this guidance that those impact assessments should include preserving traditional and cultural values, cultural diversity, community stability and livelihood of fishermen, equity among user groups, diversity among recreational and commercial users, and the role of the fishing community in American culture. So some general touchstones for the social impact analysis. Mr. Chairman, that's all I have on the scallop socioeconomic methods.
Questions from the council. Steve Gaethel.
Steve, did you explore the issue of capacity creep as it relates to this catch per unit effort data? I'm concerned that no matter what formula is used in this, that the formula is obsolete the minute you review it, and that some factor has to be built in for capacity creep, which is endless.
Thank you, David. I didn't individually analyze anything. We're lucky to have Demet on the plan development team, who did a lot of the economic analyses, and some of the economic scientists on the SSC were also involved in this. And this table of coefficients is the most of the adjustment we're going to talk about. And I think what most people feel is even the smallest coefficient, 81%, is not small enough, is that the largest vessels can fish with more than 20% greater fishing power than the lowest. The problem is coming up with data to support that type of thing. If it comes to creep, you're trying to project forward, and we don't have the data from the future yet. But I think we do need to at least recognize what these are, and these were under some regulations that affected efficiency. I think the impetus of the increased returns adjustment was to capture some of what you're talking about, is that when vessels buy or lease days, they'll become more efficient. So there was a proposal for another 10% adjustment for these increased returns. But we feel that needs more quantification than currently. We can only adjust for the data we have to adjust for. It may need some other subjective adjustments on top of that.
Anything else? Anything else on scallops? Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Moving on to our monkfish agenda item. This was to review the methods proposed by the plan development team for determining acceptable biological catch. And just as a quick orientation again to what we need to do with acceptable biological catch, for each level of exploitable stock biomass, we need to calculate the catch associated with overfishing. So this is our FMSY applied to our current exploitable biomass to derive the catch associated with overfishing. The SSC is tasked with incorporating scientific uncertainty in that determination of overfishing level to recommend an acceptable biological catch that the council cannot exceed for its annual catch limit. As discussed earlier this afternoon, annual catch targets are optional that are less than the annual catch limit so that the annual catch limit is not exceeded. So moving forward with monkfish and what information we have to determine acceptable biological catch, the council gave us very precise terms of reference, and that was to review and provide guidance on the reference points, so that's maximum sustainable yield, overfishing level of catch, acceptable biological catch, and annual catch limit. The second term of reference was to provide guidance on accountability measures and management uncertainty in considering those accountability measures. The third item was recognizing that monkfish is not annually updated, that there is a considerable lag between the last assessment and the year for which we're determining the acceptable biological catch, and what's the most appropriate way of dealing with that lag. We're fortunate that it is a relatively recent stock assessment that went through the Data Poor Stocks workshop, and there was substantial advancement of the monkfish assessment science. This used to be an index-based assessment. It moved forward to an analytical assessment, and it gives us some of the reference points we need and stock size estimates we need. However, this is at best a data moderate stock. There's uncertainty in the historical series of catch. There's uncertainty in the life history, and our previous surveys have been very noisy for monkfish. We don't catch many monkfish in the survey. So even though we've moved from an index-based assessment to an analytical assessment, substantial uncertainty remains in both components of our overfishing level of catch. The FMSY proxy, in this case, we're using an average of a time series, the maximum yield per recruit, fishing mortality, and stock size projections are also highly uncertain. In fact, the Data Poor workshop concluded that the model was not adequate for stock biomass projections. Therefore, the SSE concluded that the current analytical assessment does not support a conventional approach to determining the overfishing level of catch and the acceptable biological catch. In other words, we can't quantify the uncertainty in OFL for determining ABC. Recognizing that we can't use the default methods for determining acceptable biological catch, the SSC proposes an interim method which recognizes that both management units in the north and the south have had recent rebuilding. So in the late 90s, both management units started increasing in biomass. So we're taking a data poor proxy of simply the average exploitation rate during that time of rebuilding, that we apply that average rebuilding rate here illustrated as the dashed line, apply that harvest rate to our most current estimate of stock size to determine our interim acceptable biological catch. The result of applying that method is that we do get an ABC that is substantially less than our overfishing level. And I provide some numbers here to illustrate. You'll see the SSC report at your next council meeting where we recommend the final values, but these are just provided for examples. Using our current FMAX and our current exploitable biomass estimate, we get approximately 23,000 tons for the north and 28,000 tons for the south. These are the catches associated with overfishing. If we apply our proposed method of acceptable biological catch, we get approximately 18,000 tons in the north and 15,000 tons in the south. That's about three-quarters of the overfishing level or half the overfishing level in the north and south, respectively. And even though we didn't quantify uncertainty and we didn't base these ABC methods on uncertainty, these reductions, three-quarters of OFL and 50% of OFL, are consistent with data-poor situations in other fishery management plans. The PDT is proposing that the annual catch limit be set equal to the SSC's recommendation for acceptable biological catch. Having read National Standard 1 guidelines and reviewed it as an SSC, we feel that that's consistent with the guidelines. There is no scientific basis for a difference between ABC and ACL, that it is consistent to set ACL at ABC. But as such, if the council wishes to avoid reactive accountability measures, a target should be established below the ACL. And I know this was discussed earlier this afternoon, is do we need to have a target catch? The answer is no, not according to the guidelines. The real answer lies in whether you desire to have accountability measures or not. If you want a low risk of accountability measures, that is a payback for overages of catch, then you probably should consider a buffer below the annual catch limit. What we know best about this fishery is what the current catch is. And so just to compare our proposed method with what our current catches are, in 2006, the last year of the assessment, we caught about 7,000 tons in the north and just under 10,000 tons in the south. This is about a third of the overfishing level we're talking about. 2007 is a little less certain because we haven't evaluated the discards yet for that year, but applying status quo discard rates, we have about 5,000 tons in the north and just under 9,000 tons in the south, again, under 30% of the overfishing level. So the current level of fishing has a low risk of exceeding the overfishing level. Also has low risk of exceeding the proposed acceptable biological catch. So in the council's deliberations about what target catch should be, one thing that would help the situation is reducing the magnitude and the rate of discards. This will reduce both our scientific and our management uncertainty because a substantial part of the catch is discarded, and improving that would allow smaller buffers between OFL and ABC and whatever your catch targets are. So just to summarize, the SSC endorses the reference points that were recommended by the Data Poor Stocks Workshop. However, based on uncertainty of the assessment does not support the determination of overfishing level of catch or acceptable biological catch. Therefore, our second recommendation is to provide a proxy for acceptable biological catch. In the interim, we propose that it be based on the average exploitation rate during the recent increase in both management areas. We need to recognize this as an interim ABC and that we should continue to try to improve the assessment situation for monkfish so that we can apply more conventional approaches to acceptable biological catch. And finally, some guidance on the accountability measures, that if you wish to avoid reactive accountability measures, then catch targets should be less than the interim ABC. That's all I have on monkfish.
I should probably remember this, but why do we have a situation where we're throwing away monkfish? Is it the incidental permit that is contributing to the discards? I can't remember. Maybe Phil remembers.
There are size limits on monkfish, and there were trip limits on monkfish as well, but I'm not sure that those were the main causes of discards.
There were a number of different reasons, different fisheries. There was product quality, no market for some gillnet fish. There was the minimum size for a number of the fisheries that are catching monkfish. there, but the gillnet fishery did not cite that as a principal reason. Keep in mind that the observer coverage is not even across all fisheries, and so we, in some cases, have a very small sample of a particular fishery, but the reasons include, in some cases, trip limits or incidental catch limits. They don't distinguish in the observer reasons. So there was a number of reasons, none that stood out, except perhaps the minimum size.
What's the current understanding of the percentage of total catch that's discarded?
The north from the assessment is 14%, 0.1, it's 0.14, and in the south it's 0.22.
Just a general comment, it would seem we'd want to make that a goal of ours to knock those numbers down. I mean, monkfish, pretty valuable species. Just a general comment. Paul Howard.
Steve, our next assessment of monkfish is SARC 50, June of 2010. And that would be following a industry survey that's going on now. All that data will be in the SARC. So I think it would be very beneficial if you guys could look at what you need for ABC, that maybe you could give us some terms of reference that might be able to steer the working groups now, what information to look at to help you develop ABC for us through this next assessment, and get that to us early in case there's a lot of work that Nancy and her staff have to do.
Thank you, Paul. I think that we should start even generically to have input, and it's quantifying uncertainty in overfishing level. First of all, we need to request that the overfishing level be projected forward several years. That is typically in our term of reference already. But what we need to do is ask that all sources of uncertainty in that projected OFL be characterized and, where possible, quantified. So that we can apply a more conventional approach to ABC.
Dave Preble.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Steve, for the presentation. I'm not questioning these numbers. I just want to make sure I'm clear on this, because I've had some question from monk fishermen in the southern stock zone. The OFL set at 38,979. Seems like an enormous number compared with what was caught during the years when there was what appeared to be a collapse. And I'm wondering if the collapse, if it's your sense that that was real, first of all, or an artifact, because that was I think it was around 23,000 metric tons when the stock collapsed, supposedly. And the other question I have is, that yields an ABC of 15,000 metric tons, which to me sounds about right. Would you anticipate that as the assessments of the monkfish become better, that the OFL would come down, or that ABC would go up, or how does this play out?
Yeah, there's actually one minor clarification, is that what's in the PDT document is based on total biomass. But we recognize that there are some small monkfish that aren't exploitable. So the numbers in the SSC memo and on the screen actually apply the exploitable biomass rather than the total biomass. So it comes down a bit. But I think your general comment is still valid, is that are those numbers too high? And I think that's exactly the scientific uncertainty that we need to confront, is that if we do have large uncertainty in those, that's exactly why our ABC needs to be down more in what you think is a realistic range. Because we have uncertainty in the life history, this yield per recruit is based on natural mortality, growth, things that are poorly studied for monkfish. Our current assessment model provides us an estimate of exploitable biomass, but it in itself has some problems. So those OFL numbers could change because we feel they're uncertain. They likely will change. They could go up. They could go down. But in ABC, we need to consider that they could come down. And I think this is Chris Kellogg's view of ABC. ABC is the lowest limit that OFL could be as low as ABC. And that's what we should use as a guidepost for setting ABC, is that OFL could be as low as ABC.
Thank you. Just one more thing. The apparent collapse that occurred several years ago, is that now thought to be something that really did happen?
I think the answer would have to be yes. And the blue line on both these plots shows the exploitable biomass from both management units. This model is based on survey data, so during those times, there were few fish caught in the surveys, but it's also based on the size structure of monkfish. And the mean size had decreased quite a bit in the early 90s. Both the size structure and the survey indices have increased since then. So I think we believe that there was a decline, but we also believe in the increase, which is the basis of our interim method.
So that would, if correct me if I'm wrong here, but that would kind of argue that the 38,979 is probably on the high side.
I think I would focus that a little bit, is that the fishing mortality estimates during that period were not sustainable, and that we wouldn't want to have our ABC based on those high fishing mortalities. We want them more on the rebuilding fishing mortalities.
Mary Beth.
Thank you. Just one question, Steve. When you look at the reductions from ABC or from OFL to ABC in the south and in the north, you end up with different percentages. And I was just curious why that is.
Yeah, it's an excellent question. I think the quick answer is because we didn't base the ABC on our buffer below OFL. If we had, we'd probably try to be consistent in what that buffer was. We based it on an ad hoc proxy, which was what's the exploitation rate during the increase. It turns out that these are the buffers that that method produces. They're in the range of a data poor default buffer, but that's not how they were developed. They weren't based on scientific uncertainty. They were an ad hoc method. So that's the reason they're different, is because we didn't derive them to achieve a buffer. We derived them to recommend what we think is a sustainable exploitation rate.
Okay. Anyone else on the council? Dr. Pierce.
Steve, in the memo from you to Paul on methods for determining annual catch limits, you have a statement relative to the need to go to a method that does not conform to National Standard Number 1 guidelines because it just can't be done. So you're recommending, the SSC is recommending, an interim method for determining ABC using average exploitation rate. And here's my point: using the most recent estimate or index of exploitable biomass. Do the SSC spend any time on, devote any energy to a discussion of the implications of our going to the Bigelow and are not being able to sample all the depth strata that we used to be able to sample with the albatross? Is there any impact? Well, has the SSC got into that kind of discussion? And do we need to go in that direction, that is, to have a discussion along those lines so we have confidence that the average exploitation rate that was calculated during that recent period of stable or increasing trend of biomass that we got from the albatross, right, that the Bigelow data can now be compared to that?
That's correct. Without calibration, the two series will be different. We did have quite a bit of conversation about that at the SSC, and the reason the recommendation is worded the way it is to give some flexibility to the PDT and to the next peer review for June 2010, that they would have options available to them. If updating this analytical model is the best science available, then we can still apply an ABC method to that. If we can't get more uncertainty or a better quantification of uncertainty, we can use this method to what the new peer review produces. If that peer review panel decides that the Bigelow series is the better estimate of exploitable biomass, it can use that. We didn't want to be overly prescriptive in what the assessment method was. This interim method should work with the best science available and what the method is. Right now, the best science available is from the 2007 data pool workshop. The 2010 peer review may come up with a better way of estimating biomass. And we were trying to be flexible to allow that, and it would still allow that the 2011 fishing year could be based on the new assessment.
Okay, so there may be, based upon additional work to be done in the future, there may be a better method to calculate biomass. I think you just said that. And I think you also said that the method that has been offered up right now by the SSC to be used on an interim basis is contingent on the fact that we actually can't come up with a compatibility factor, some conversion factor, albatross versus the Bigelow.
You heard me correct. There's an exercise going on this summer to evaluate calibration between the two series, the albatross series, Bigelow series. We also have an opportunity with monkfish where we've had three cooperative surveys. And that third survey will be very valuable in bridging between the albatross and the Bigelow. We're very hopeful that the net configuration in the fishing system of the Bigelow will be much more sensitive to monkfish biomass and will give us in the long term a better index of monkfish abundance. The albatross fishing system wasn't particularly efficient at catching monkfish.
Anyone else in the council? Okay. Steve?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Moving on to the habitat item. Thank you, Phil. We had very precise terms of reference for our EFH review. We had a general term of reference to evaluate the sufficiency of the model as a basis for analyzing alternatives to minimize the adverse effects from fishing on essential fishing habitat and provide the council with commentary on the adequacy of each component. There were four major components to the model. I don't want to go into the fine print, but the SSC reviewed in detail each of these methodological components. First of all, the SSC would like to credit the Habitat PDT for breaking new ground. This is not a conventional fishery science where they could rely on previous work. They really need to go into the literature in a great extent, find out what's been done worldwide on fishing impacts on habitat, and they've done a remarkable job and put together a very powerful team on the PDT. An example of having to reach out is we had to expand the SSC's expertise as well. Dr. Robert Whitlock is an expert in benthic ecology and recovery of impacted habitats, and was a very valuable member in our deliberations. We'll continue to work with the PDT as we approach the deadline for the Phase 2 amendment. We actually need to identify what the habitat team was asked to do and what the SSC was asked to do. Our review was focused on Phase 2 of essential fish habitat. Phase 1 identifies what is essential fish habitat and what are areas of particular concern. Those are not the analyses that we were reviewing. We were narrowly focused on evaluating the adverse effects of fishing on habitat. And so we clearly did not get back into some of the issues with Phase 1. However, we felt that the Phase 2 analyses were generally consistent with those done for Phase 1 in that it's incorporating the entire Northeast Continental Shelf as potential essential fish habitat. Because the objectives of Phase 1 and Phase 2 are different and different methods are used, they are likely going to come up with different answers with respect to sensitive habitats or habitats of particular concern. We just want to identify that right off the bat, that there are good reasons that things may be different. We also need to recognize that this is designed to evaluate fishing impacts and can't necessarily be used for other impacts. You have a CD with the same materials from the habitat team that the SSC was given, and I'd like to encourage each council member to look at that CD and become somewhat familiar with the nature of the different components. The first component is the vulnerability analysis. And this table may be too small to read, but I just want to steer through what's in it. Essentially, it classifies different substrates. We have mud, sand, pebbles. What the features are that are important to our fish resources, what the effects of fishing are, and what scientific studies those effects are based on. Based on the results in these scientific studies, the PDT scored a susceptibility score, and so this is for otter trawling on mud. How susceptible is that mud habitat to trawling? And then whether it's in a high-energy environment or a low-energy environment, and that is it an environment that does not get a lot of natural disturbance, so a low-energy environment, or an environment that has frequent natural disturbance? Using that distinction, the PDT determined what the recovery time, how slow or fast recovery would be from a fishing impact. And so there's just one example. In this example, it's trawl gear on mud and sand, but there are numerous tables in the EFH document, in the PDT's document, on the susceptibility and recovery of each substrate type to each type of fishing gear. This is almost entirely based on literature review, and no literature review is entirely comprehensive. But we did feel as an SSC that this was an adequate basis to move forward with the development of analytical tools. In general, the matrix-based structure, and by that I mean just that table structure of classifying different substrate types and the effects of different fishing gears on those substrate types, was appropriate. There was one badly missing element to this, and the PDT recognizes this, is that all of the vulnerability analysis is based on geological components of habitat, mud, sand, gravel, boulder, and did not include or consider biological components of habitat, tube worms, other types of biological components of habitat. And so in order for the omnibus amendment to provide methods that can be used, all components of habitat, including biological components, need to be included. Moving on to the second analytical component, it was the area swept of fishing effort. This was also classified by gear. Here's an example, again, for demersal otter trawl. And the swept area seabed impact is simply the area for a unit of fishing effort. And they're just geometric calculations, in this case using the distance towed, the width of an otter board, the contact index of an otter board, the width of the ground cable, the contact index of the ground cable, both of those are multiplied by 2, and the width of the sweep and the contact index of the sweep. So with every otter trawl tow, this formula calculates the footprint of that tow. The SSC felt that this was an appropriate approach to evaluating seabed impact, but we suggested some modifications to characterize fishing effort. For example, there are different types of sweeps, some with roller gear, some with cookies, that may have different contact indices, and that those differences should be considered in the final analysis. The third component was the spatial analysis. And that was classifying the entire Northeast Shelf into different habitat types. This was done with 3 data sources. The data sources were the U.S. Geological Survey sediment maps, the point samples from those sediment maps, the trawl survey locations of hangs, and the SMAS video survey used to classify the entire shelf to one of those substrate types that we saw in the matrix earlier. The SSC's feedback was that heterogeneity within spatial areas needs to be considered where you may have a trawl hang. In fact, it's best illustrated here south of Cape Hatteras. That brown area indicates all boulders. We know that that area is not all boulders. It's simply because all the only information we had there are survey hangs. So it just illustrates some of the issues that are going up further north, that we need to consider heterogeneous data, that we may have some indicators of sand right next to a survey hang, and we need to better account for that heterogeneity. The analysis also used an oceanographic model to identify what areas are high energy and low energy, and we have some technical feedback on how to improve that analysis as well. Moving into the final phase of this methodology, the final result will be that the council can use this analysis to determine what the fishing impacts are of alternative decisions. And just as an example here, we have the relative habitat effects of the scallop dredge survey, and here just as examples, 4 years, what the contact adjusted area swept was, so 19,000 square kilometers, 17,000 square kilometers. Adjust those for the sensitivity of the habitat that they fish on. So the map to the right is a sensitivity score, is what the shades of blue are. More sensitive habitats are darker blue. And so here, adjusting the footprint of a management decision with the area that it'll fish on, so that the council might get different indices of the habitat impacts of different management options. So this is the end game that we have in mind for the omnibus amendment, that we might be able to quantify what the habitat effects are for different management alternatives. Finally, we felt that the approach of sensitivity-adjusted fishing areas is the best science available at the current time. However, the quantification of sensitivity needs to be improved by more conventional methods. We also need greater spatial resolution of fishing effort. The current analyses are based on statistical areas, and that gives us a fairly crude assessment of the area impacted. Again, we feel that this is a valid approach to evaluating fishing impacts. However, it's critical that we include the biological components of habitat. Until those biological components are included, we feel that the methodology is not ready for the Omnibus 2 amendment, and we will continue to work with the PDT in developing a methodology that is ready for the amendment. That's all I have on habitat.
Dr. Pierce.
Yes, Steve, could you go back to slide 24? Right. Okay, I'm trying to understand the message that you, the SSC is providing regarding, let's say, 1999 contact adjusted AS, which is the area swept 17,521 square nautical miles. What is that? It's square kilometers. Okay. And then that's adjusted for the scallop dredge, so that it's 6,149. What's the message from that?
It's a good question, David. And I think this table does give us a good example of what this methodology can give us. Is that, of course, we had different fishing efforts, different catch decisions about 97, 98, 99. The first thing this methodology does is translate that fishing effort into a footprint, into the area swept by that fishing effort. We now adjust that footprint for the types of habitat that that footprint covers. If it's on more sensitive habitat that's sensitive to a scallop dredge, it's going to increase the sensitivity adjusted area swept. If the scallop dredge is going over high energy sand where it has no impact at all, then the sensitivity adjusted area swept is zero. It gets a score of zero applied to its area swept. So dredging on non-sensitive bottom doesn't go into the sensitivity-adjusted area swept.
So that means then that the swept area in 1999 was 17,521 square kilometers, and of that total, 6,149 square kilometers were impacted. What does the word impact mean?
We need to go back to the matrix. It means that there was an impact to that habitat that has different levels of recovery, a permanent impact or impacts where the habitat can recover. And so this sensitivity score incorporates the susceptibility of the habitat and the habitat's capacity to recover.
Okay, so that means then, I think, you're saying of the 6,149 square kilometers, we need to go to some other table to find where, to find the exact amount of swept area square kilometers that would be sensitive to scallop dredging, meaning there would be some adverse impact that we would have to somehow deal with. Is that the message?
I think you're on it, David, is that it's similar to our bycatch or discard discussion we just had. When you have high discard, you try to isolate what the source of those discards are. If you have a high sensitivity adjusted area swept, you might want to identify what are the sensitive habitats that's driving up that number. And if we stayed away from that area, might we be able to get a higher catch with a lower sensitivity adjusted area swept? So I think you would want to use a map like this to identify where you want to stay away from or where you want to focus your effort in.
Anyone else on the council? Dave Preble.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First of all, Steve, I want to thank you for the work that the SSC did on this. It was needed. It was at the right time, and it's going to help us to move forward more expeditiously. I'd also like to thank you for the remarks about the PDT, the work that they did, and particularly Chad. I think that the PDT did an absolutely remarkable job on this. Above and beyond the call of duty, and Chad as well, and I wanted to make sure I said that. Two of the things that this will do that that weren't part of the original intent was the model itself, as we move on, is a self-improving model. As we plug data into it, it gets better with time. That was one of the things that I wanted to see happen, and in fact, that's what's emerged in the model. And the other thing that I think is going to turn out to be more important than I had anticipated is that it's going to help us to direct research, because what is emerging is areas where we don't know enough. And this gives us a really graphic representation of what those areas of research are that need to be done. And I think that's another strong point of this that's going to emerge as one of its true functions. So at any rate, thank you. Thank the SSC.
Dave Gaethel.
Thank you. Steve, if I could focus your attention on bullet number four, the sentence that starts, however, a more formal and transparent method is needed for the derivation of the sensitivity criteria. Could you tell me a little bit more about what it is exactly that the SSC was looking for?
Yeah, as I described earlier, this sensitivity score is a combination of the susceptibility of a given habitat to a given fishing gear and the ability of that habitat to recover. So susceptibility was scored for a mud bottom had a certain susceptibility to otter trawling, but that mud bottom has a certain score of recovery. The combination of those probably could use some improvement. There are some mathematical methods to take people's scores, and it's used in a lot of policy science, to come up with a more transparent, mathematically repeatable method that can be done. If this is going to be the basis of management decisions, or at least one component of the basis of management decisions, then we feel that we need to have some more repeatability. We need to remove some of the subjectivity in those scorings, and more so the combination of those scorings. That's what we meant by a more formal and transparent method.
Okay, great. These are things the committee really wrestled with, and a lot of the terms of reference we wrote for the review were to get a second opinion on how to deal with these issues. That's why I'm going to ask some pretty specific questions here, because we really spent a lot of time trying to figure out how, as a committee, to deal with some of these issues. And the second half of that sentence is, its uncertainty is a function of susceptibility and recovery. Again, we had a real hard time with trying to quantify uncertainty when, in essence here, this is a qualitative process, by and large. Basically, susceptibility is in the eye of the beholder. You know, one person says, oh, my God, that's horrible, and another person goes, oh, my God, who cares? So, again, some more. If there's any more advice there as to how to fix that section, we would be appreciative.
Yeah, I actually would like to get more into that, and I'll go back and I encourage you to look at these tables, because they do get at what David's talking about some of the subjectivity. Is this S is a susceptibility score, and it's the average of all the scores that the PDT members provided. What I clipped off here, maybe I was trying to avoid it, was the standard deviation of the susceptibility scores. Is that some of these, there was fairly good agreement, and you have a very low standard deviation of that score. Some of them, there was a lot of difference of opinion, as you said, and so there was a high standard deviation. But that's exactly what these more formal mathematical methods will retain. They'll retain what susceptibility scores we're more certain about than others. And it can use difference of opinion. Even though it is somewhat subjective, it can identify what susceptibility measures we know with certainty and which ones we don't, or maybe which ones need more research.
Okay, so then the PDT then has been made aware of these mathematical formulas that they can apply, and they'll be able to report those to the committee so we can, you know, help get on with this.
Yeah, I should have made clear that there's a complimentary memo to the PDT with technical feedback. And there we provide scientific references to the methods that we're talking about. We try not to be too vague to them so that we can add value to what they're doing. So there is much more detail on what we mean there.
And I guess my last, it's not a question, it would be more a comment, is basically the SSC feels we're on the right track here, that with some modifications and some changes and some tweaks here and there, that you know, at least we're headed in the right direction with something that is, to me, pretty complicated and, you know, kind of a pretty fancy gizmo we're building here.
That was our general recommendation to the council, is that the general approach is scientifically valid, and it combines all the information available to form the best science available to us right now.
And that it's a fancy gizmo. Okay. Anyone else on the council? Okay. Steve?
All right. I'll just close by giving you our plans for next month. Next month, we'll be evaluating the Monkfish ABC recommendations. That is the values of catch for 2010, 2011, conditional on the methodology we just talked about. And we'll go over the methods to determine acceptable biological catch for both herring and groundfish. So we'll have a full two-day meeting, April 30th, 1st of May, and we will report to the council on June 22nd, or that at that council meeting. And also looking a little bit more further, in July we're planning a workshop on ecosystem-based management with the objective of developing a white paper for council consideration.
Thanks, Steve. Any comments from the council? Any questions for Steve? Oh. Sally McGee.
Sorry, I'm just thinking off the top of my head on the ecosystem-based management topic. I know that, you know, you're already kind of thinking way ahead and probably beyond what, you know, the speed at which the council normally works, but in the discussions that we had about the mixed stock exception, there was discussion about ecosystem-based management, and my hope is that ultimately we are going to be moving in that direction. I think that we're going to need to take the input of the SSC to do that as deliberately as possible. So I would just put a placeholder for the council to consider how we might consider giving some direction to the SSC on addressing the issues that we're still struggling with, that the mixed stock exception discussion is just kind of the tip of the iceberg, and it's not really, it's not ultimately, I don't think, going to be the solution to getting us to a system that's really going to work. So, you know, when you say that, that makes me think, okay, there's one potential place where we can be really working towards solutions rather than having the kind of debate that we had earlier this afternoon. Right now, I don't know what else to say other than, you know, that raises a flag for me as a great opportunity to advance some ideas that we were just kind of struggling with the fringes this morning.
Well, I attended the that SSC meeting, and I know that Steve led the committee through a brief discussion about this workshop. I don't know if you feel comfortable just touching on some of the high points of that discussion.
Yeah, Bob O'Boyle is taking the lead on this, but we've had several SSC discussions, conference calls, trying to say, what are we trying to do? The initial impetus was that we felt that focusing on ABC recommendations was our mandated job, but as an SSC, we have a larger job to the council, and that is to perhaps advance the science behind council decisions. What we would like this to do is to be focused on implementation. We don't want this to be a scientific symposium where people come tell us their most recent research. We really would like to pick out what have other areas of the world been doing, what's working in other places, and what might the New England Council want to consider. We think this is the start of a dialogue. So as such, we would welcome any desired things that you want us to touch on. The council is our client in this, is that we want to develop a white paper of directions that we could consider, more precise ways of doing it, trying to really define what we mean by ecosystem-based management so that the council can consider that and get back to us, perhaps which ones they think would work, which ones they think wouldn't work. So we would welcome feedback even at this stage to help focus our discussions for this summer, and we hope that this is the first of many dialogues on the topic between the council and the SSC.
Okay, anything further from the council? Okay. Thank you, Dr. Cadron. I believe that concludes our business for today. It does.
One more?
Oh, Mary Beth.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My questions weren't directed to Steve, so I wanted to let him finish up, but I was curious if we have are we being systematic in developing terms of reference for the SSC? I mean, on the Herring Committee, I don't believe we really talked about terms of reference. We will have a meeting before the SSC meets. Scallop Committee, I don't recall any discussion about terms of reference for this particular item. Maybe it happened in the past, and that's why. But I'm just curious, do we have, like, a systematic method we're using?
Yes, we established a policy that was approved by the council so that I don't have it in front of me, but maybe we can copy it or print it. In our ops handbook, the policy for setting terms of reference, remember, Pat, we just did that, right? Yeah.
I remember the policy. It's just then we'll take the policy and we implement it. You know, who's actually developing the terms of reference?
The council also saw, along with the policy, which wasn't very specific about the terms of reference, it just said we will, you know, establish them, is there was a sheet of paper with generic terms of reference that the staff worked on and was submitted to the council as well as the SSC. It wasn't a formal part of the policy, but generic terms of reference go through all of the issues that the SSC could go through with a priority based on the priorities, obviously, the ABCs. We've found out, as the committee goes forward with its work, that ABCs are taking a whole lot more time than other components of the FMP at hand. And so we've been primarily focused on methods for setting ABC and then what the output is at a second and subsequent meeting. The SSC's also looked at social and economic impacts, and they're doing that across every fishery management plan. And that is all embedded in the generic terms of reference, which maybe I should append to the policy and also mail out to the council. But you've all seen it a couple of times, but it may have, you know, gone by you.
And what generated my questions and concerns is that in the terms of reference for monkfish, the term requests that the SSC comment on management uncertainty and ACLs, and I quite frankly think that is a role for the council, and I was just curious about who was asking them to comment on that, because I don't believe the council had that discussion.
I don't recall having that discussion at the council table, no.
Yeah.
Chris.
In the SSC process, the council expressed an interest in understanding whether a management program would meet its stated objectives. I think that, you know, that's a very broad topic. One aspect of that is management uncertainty. So it's not bound by what you've asked the SSC, but you might want to have that information. Might help you at some point.
Well, I think that brings up an important point. I think it's been made by, it was made by Dr. Sissonwine, by Bob O'Boyle, by I think just about every SSC member at some point in all the meetings I've attended has indicated a desire for the council to communicate to the SSC a certain level of risk that we're comfortable with when it comes not necessarily just to the scientific side of things, but when they eventually will review the plan before the council votes on it, it is conceivable that they'll take a look at the management side of things that we are proposing and look at the ACL level or the ACT level, whatever it happens to be in the plan, and make comments back to us about the appropriateness there. It's not that we're bound to their recommendations, but SSC members have indicated that it's difficult for them to know what the tolerance or appetite at the council level is on risk. So, you know, I think there's people that think it's completely inappropriate for the SSC to talk about management risk, and that's the purview of the council and the function of the PDT. I'm not speaking about SSC members. I'm speaking about people at the table and people in the audience. They don't want the SSC involved in evaluating or discussing management uncertainties. But nothing prohibits the SSC from doing that. And nothing compels the council or binds the council to what their advice or their thoughts are would be on that issue. So I don't think that we're I don't think that we want to communicate back to the SSC, hey, just give us the ABC and get out of our way. I think we want them to comment on every facet of this process as a partner here. We're not bound by their feelings on those issues, but I wouldn't want to send the signal to the chair and back to the SSC that, hey, keep your nose out of our business, because that's not the way I see it. Dr. Pierce.
Yeah, just in light of what you just said, I don't have it in front of me, you know, the schematic describing how plans flow from one group to the next. I think you just said that when we finish a plan, it goes to the SSC for review, right? Okay, so that's in the schematic. That's all right. So they would then review it to determine if what we have decided to do has adequately accounted for their recommendations. What, again, I don't have it in front of me. I need to know how much power we've given the SSC.
We've asked them to take another look, if you remember the schematic, to have a final glance over the plan to make sure that everything lines up and that we're not wildly off course with our proposed management strategy as it relates to what's available in terms of the stock.
So if indeed we do request them to offer some advice regarding management uncertainty, they give us that advice early on in the process. We then either accept it, use it, or not. The document is then completed. The plan is then completed. We give it back to the SSC. Will they come back and say, you didn't abide by our recommendations? Does that put us in a kind of a conflict situation with them? I hope not, because that's just not productive. I mean, once we decide what we're going to do with management uncertainty, then that should be it. And once the SSC sees it again, I mean, I would think their input should be minimal, because they've had their shot at it, and we've either used it or not. It's critical, of course, that they give us that scientific uncertainty, and we of course, apply it. But otherwise, I get nervous that we could end up in an awkward situation with the SSC, and I don't want that to happen because, you know, their input is too valuable, and I don't want to alienate them by getting us into that situation where they may feel like we are, in the end, not abiding by their management uncertainty advice. We have to avoid that at all costs.
I guess rather than perhaps muddy the waters even more, I would ask the chair of the SSC at his next meeting to query the members of the SSC that have made these comments about what's the council's appetite for the level of uncertainty or the level of risk, and report back to us. You know, and I'll be at the meeting, so I'll ask the question myself, but please clarify those requests. Steve.
Yeah, this is something that we have recognized as well. We had a term of reference for Monkfish to evaluate accountability measures and targets. And I guess I'd like feedback from what you got. Essentially, we reported that a target catch would avoid the reactive accountability measures, and we also identified that discards were a source of both scientific and management uncertainty. So rather than recommend on what the target should be, what the buffer should be, that's probably the nature that the SSC is prepared to provide. Is information that comes across us in determining the ABC that the council may want to be aware of in considering its ACLs or its catch targets. So part of it is understanding the mechanism of the new reauthorization. Part of it is understanding the information on the fishery and the assessment and what may be used for them. It's just identify them without a value judgment. Unless we hear differently, that's probably how we'll approach this, is to just give you information without a strong recommendation to do one thing or another.
Just along these lines, in terms of comments that I've picked up on at the meetings, was another discussion item I think Dr. Sissonwine raised was the need to have clarity on status determination criteria control rules, if I have it right. Is that right?
That's correct. Is that the current National Standard 1 guidelines say that the SSC can only provide ABC recommendations if there's an approved ABC control rule in the plan. And so that's why we're spending time in our agenda to go over the method of deriving ABC, like we just did for Monkfish, so that once that's approved, we can then provide ABC recommendations for the next year. But until it's part of the plan, those are interim recommendations.
And I sensed from some of the comments, like from Steve, or from Dr. Sissonwine, that it's sort of a chicken and egg situation. It's a little frustrating for him, and I think for several other members of the SSC. Okay. Anything further from the council? Nope. Okay. Thank you very much, Dr. Cajun. I guess that's it. We'll see you tomorrow at 8:30. As I brought up this morning, Dr. Lubchenko will be here first thing. I think she's asked for a little bit of time to address the council and hopefully some opportunity for questions and answers. And then we'll take up with skates after that. Thanks.